Good afternoon. The time for the court's argument on two cases today. We're starting with Irina Anzell versus Douglas Anzell, case 83916-COA. I see Mr. Willick here for the appellant. It looks like you're outnumbered though. So Mr. Smith is in the middle. Does that mean you're arguing? Okay. And Mr. Jones and Mr. Polzenberg, right? Well, I'm fortunate today to have my two colleagues, Judge Bonnie Bulla and Judge Deborah Westbrook, here with me, so we're not going to be outnumbered. We thought we might have this case heard, I believe it was the end of January. Okay, so don't ever talk about the Court of Appeals causing any delays in this case. If there were delays, they were somebody else. All right, Mr. Willick, do you want to reserve any time for your rebuttal?
5 minutes.
Okay. Well, there are a lot of issues. We're going to leave it up to you to decide which ones you want to focus on. The court will have a few questions, but we recently read where the U.S. Supreme Court will allow questions from counsel to extend the argument for an indefinite period of time. We're not going to follow that approach, but we will try to give you every opportunity to make your argument first without interrupting you. All right, Mr. Willick, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Judge, judges, Marshall Willick for Irina Anzell, may it please the court. This case concerns the appropriate judicial response on appeal to plain error resulting from a total abdication of the judicial function by a judge who's been disciplined for doing exactly that in multiple cases and has been barred from ever taking another case. The case has been a train wreck since Doug illicitly got the assigned judge to recuse by way of an ex parte, illicit, and unethical contact. Despite the size of the record, which is enormous, mainly due to Doug's gross over-litigation of the case for multiple years, the issues involved in this case are actually pretty simple, consisting of pretty basic community property law, enforcement of a valid prenup, and some civil procedure questions. On the property issues, since the valid prenup specifically requires that the same method be used for valuation to value the businesses at the beginning and at the end of the marriage, and the only competent evidence before the court was Mr. Roston's report, which did exactly that, Irina is entitled to half of the $9.9 million valuation between those two numbers as a matter of case law that's been in effect for a long time, ALBA.
Well, Mr. Willick, let me ask you this question. You talk about the Roston's evaluation being the only proper method, but how did the other methods differ from that? What is the error?
The error is that Mr. Hall, who was Doug's personal accountant, admitted, and it's in the briefs, I gave you the transcript of the testimony from Mr. Hall, he admitted that he simply made up the opening value. And if you have a made-up opening value and a valued final number, they are not the same method definitionally. And that produced a multi-million dollar variation in the total amount of the value of the businesses. You can't start with them.
Any spot in the record where this was said, this made-up?
Yes. Yes. I gave you the transcript of Mr. Hall's deposition testimony. Now, exactly where that deposition testimony is in this vast record, I can't tell you.
Can you point to a place in the record where you made this specific argument that only Mr. Roston's valuation could be used? As best as we could tell, looking at the record, the first time I could find that argument made to the district court was in the untimely motion or counter motion that was post decree.
I'm pretty sure it's in the closing argument, but this record is vast enough that I cannot cite you chapter and verse of exactly what was said where. We were arguing for use of the Roston valuation specifically because he followed the methodology.
Well,
and we knew
from what I could tell, you were arguing that his methodology was better than the others, that it was a superior valuation, and that it was a credibility determination between the various experts.
I wasn't arguing credibility. I was arguing valuation methodology. And I can't tell you the exact words used. I'm sorry. It's just been too long. But the question of appropriate methodology for valuation was the question at trial. The thing was...
But did you ever tell Judge Seda that the only valuation she could use was Roston's because he was the only one that used the same methodology? That's a very specific argument.
I can't tell you that that sentence was ever uttered. I'm sorry. I simply don't recall. I can't tell you whether those words ever left my mouth, but those are the facts. The prenup was deemed valid, and it would be a simple error to admit any other valuation that would be correctable at this point, even if I didn't say those words.
Mr. Wilk, I just want to make sure I understand. When you said that Mr. Hall made up the opening value, are you speaking to the initial evaluation that was done in December of 2012? To begin the as the starting point for the value of the businesses?
Yes. If you read the deposition transcript that's in the footnote in the brief, there was no valuation. He simply accepted numbers from Doug personally and assumed them.
That's just what I want to clarify today. What you're telling us is that the made up value were not the numbers that were from the December 2012 evaluation of the properties or businesses.
We may be speaking across purposes. Whose valuation are you talking about?
Well, you indicated to us a few minutes ago that Mr. Hall made up the opening values to do a comparison, because the whole idea is that these businesses or properties were valued in December of 2012, and then at some point upon the dissolution of the marriage, they had to be revalued to determine how we were going to compare the two values between the businesses and also the properties.
We never did what the prenup required. He was required to do a valuation at the time of the marriage and didn't. And he simply went back and took a look at what his accountant had made up when we got to the point of divorce. So that's the plain error on the businesses.
Well, you have a statement in your opening brief in your argument that only Mr. Roston used the same method for both. There's no citation to the record, and I'm not sure where you're able to get that conclusion.
Well, the Roston report is three volumes and some hundreds of pages, so I know that it's in there. He used the same build-up capitalization rates in the beginning and the end.
But aren't you required to cite to the record in order for us to be able to accurately and adequately review your contentions on appeal?
It's very hard to cite to the absence of something. What we know is that Mr. Hall admitted to making up the opening number. We also know that Mr. Roston used the same valuation method for both. I don't have a page of the record where those words are said to the district court judge, but it's a true statement from the record itself. As to the pay down on the other assets, under 125, 150, and Block O, pay down of mortgages with community assets was an increase in the value of that separate property. Doug's efforts or lack of efforts are entirely irrelevant. And a community property interest is a one-half interest under statutory law. That's NRS 123.225. So IRENA is entitled as a matter of statutory law to half of that increase in value. That's another $880,000. No compelling reason was ever suggested for any other result. The provision that IRENA was to receive half the income that Doug received during the marriage isn't complicated at all. Most of this stuff is really simple. Just between the separation at the beginning of the divorce proceedings and the time of divorce, Doug admitted to receiving about $1.1 million in income. IRENA is simply entitled on the face of the prenup to $560,000. She didn't get it. And that doesn't include the vast sums Doug took as income and kept before the divorce proceedings began that he didn't share with her. The valid prenup prohibits any finding that IRENA is liable for tax liabilities on Doug's companies on its face. for at least three reasons. They are taxes on Doug's separate property. The prenup explicitly makes them Doug's separate responsibility. It's undisputed that he borrowed the money to pay in advance the taxes for his companies, and Irina never signed anything agreeing to be liable, and the prenup specifically requires that to hold her liable. So no court anywhere is allowed to hold her liable for those debts. And third, they were already taking account in Mr. Rosten's business valuation to reduce the value of the companies, so she's already effectively paid those taxes, which means that if she's again held liable, she's paid them twice.
But Mr. Willick, is tax liability a secured or unsecured debt? Or does it matter?
The prenup doesn't use the word secured or unsecured to the best of my knowledge, but I don't think it makes a difference.
Is it fair for Irina to receive the income for the time during the time of the marriage and treat that income as community property and not receive community debt? I.e. the tax liability during that time frame?
The tax liability is on the companies. And the prenup specifically says that that's Doug's sole responsibility.
But is it really that clear in Section 21 of the prenup?
I can't give you the section numbers off the top of my head.
Section 21 is actually entitled Unsecured Debt Responsibility, and that's the section where all of that language comes from. So
all the tax liability language.
Right, but if you read that whole paragraph, it talks about his sole and separate property businesses and all liabilities attributable to those obligations.
And does it specifically say that he will be responsible for the tax liability during the marriage for the income that is treated as community property?
Yes, he's responsible for all debts attributable to his separate property businesses. She doesn't get an ownership interest in those businesses under the terms of the prenup. And that's the trade-off that's made under the prenup. But she's entitled to half the income. She's entitled to half the increase in the value of those businesses. The prenup is not really that complicated. It's not a perfect prenup, very few of them are, but it's clear enough on its face. Turning to the civil procedure issues, I think the NRCP 54 issue is clear enough, but I see that I'm at my reserved time.
Go ahead and finish your point, please.
Under NRCP 54, a motion for fees has to be filed within 20 days of the notice of entry of the underlying judgment. The first trial was in 2016 on custody. A notice of entry was done at that time. Fees were awarded at that time on contested cross motions. There is no provision in law under which 4 years later, after a third and unrelated trial, you can go back in time and ask for fees for a trial on which a notice of entry was 4 years earlier and fees have already been awarded. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Willick. We'll turn to Mr. Smith. I assume you won't start with the same phrase that this trial was a train wreck.
You stole my line, Chief Judge Gibbons. Good afternoon, Chief Judge Gibbons, and may it please the court. Abe Smith for respondent. I actually do want to start with something that Mr. Willick brought up. He mentioned this issue of abdication, and that seemed to be a theme throughout the briefing, charging that Senior Judge Seda had abdicated her responsibility, that Judge Duckworth abdicated his responsibility in recusing himself, and that Doug has somehow abdicated his responsibility to prove the scope of Irina's appeal. But I do want to address that last point first, because we have a serious issue of appellate jurisdiction that can't be waived. Under NRAP C31, the notice of appeal must designate the judgment, order, or part thereof being appealed. Obviously, that we have extensive case law interpreting what this means. We have the Collins case that says you can look to the text of the notice, and it's an objective standard, and then we get a gloss in Foreman, and I'll even take the unpublished order in Martin that say you can have additional or supplemental to the notice of appeal with something like a case appeal statement, so long as that's filed within the same period as the notice of appeal. And that's also consistent with federal practice under the former Rule 3C that governed before the amendments in 2021. And we cited the PHL variable case on that. The problem is here, Irina did not designate the amended decree in her notice of appeal. She only appealed from the post-judgment order, which, as we pointed out, that actually made sense. At page, I believe it's at page, I'll have to find it later. I think it's at page 20 of their opening brief. Irina even says that, you know, she claims to be the prevailing party because Doug did not get everything that he wanted in the decree. So it made sense that she was only appealing from the post-judgment decree because it seemed like everybody was willing to live with the decree itself.
So I have a question about that.
Yes.
Let's say she appeals from a post-judgment decree. This post-judgment decree has appealable aspects to it and non-appealable aspects because Irina filed what the district court deemed untimely, but it was a counter motion to alter or amend, correct?
Correct.
And then the court denied that. That's not an appealable order. You don't have a right to appeal from the denial of a motion to alter or amend. But you do have a right to appeal from a grant of a motion to alter or amend. So that particular order that disposed of both appealable and non-appealable issues, they were all wrapped up into one. And there's authority in Nevada that when you notice a non-appealable order, the court will look to other appealable orders sometimes. If it's, for instance, you file a notice, you appeal from the notice of entry of order, the court will look back to the order that was entered because you can't appeal from a notice, but you can appeal. The court infers the intent to appeal from that underlying order. Why can't we do that in this case?
So
to infer the intent to appeal from the motion that he lost, or that Irina lost.
And I have two answers to that. I suppose the easiest answer is that I think you actually can appeal from the denial of 52B relief. I know there are some cases from the 70s that talk about a distinction between a denial and a grant, but I believe the court's modern practice is that any post-judgment relief, I believe the Lytle versus Rosemere case, talks about an appeal from a denial of 59E relief. And so, yeah, you can have an appeal from a denial of a denial of 52B relief. It's just that because that was an untimely motion, it's just not a very good appeal. The second piece that I'll say to that is that actually you correctly identified that, yeah, this is an appealable order. And as we've seen,
parts of it are.
Well, once you have an appealable order, anything that even non-appealable aspects can become appealable so long as they're integrated into that order. So, for example, if you have an injunction, and along with the injunction there's a contempt order, right? An order imposing a contempt sanction is not itself appealable, but if it's combined with an appealable order like an injunction, then the appellate court can review both.
Well, that's sort of like an interlocutory. You treat it as the final order when the final order issues. But this, I mean, in this case, especially given the extensive litigation with millions of dollars at stake, the fact that Irina got nothing, I mean, why wouldn't it have been obvious that she intended to appeal from the underlying divorce decree here? I mean, was she just going to give that up?
Well, I don't think she didn't get nothing. I mean, she was awarded over $900,000. In the initial
reduced
decree,
to nothing
as a result of the attorney's fees, right? And so we did understand that she was appealing the attorney's fees.
Yeah, it wasn't just the attorney's fees. I think it was also the
tax liability
and the adjudication of the tax. You are correct.
So I mean, there can't be really that much surprise here that we would have to go back and take a look at the divorce decree to analyze the tax liability issues, the property distribution issues, which were not final until the final order that is currently before us, right?
Well, I mean, I do think that the property distribution issues were final.
At the time of the decree?
At the time of the amended decree, yeah.
Okay. In the language in the amended decree would suggest to you that they were final when didn't the district court suggest that she wasn't sure what the tax liability was, and that she reserved the right to.
You're correct. She reserved jurisdiction over the tax liability. I'm not certain that would deprive this court of jurisdiction over the amended decree because it's still a final judgment. But nonetheless, I'd be happy to move to the merits of the appeal, because I know you had some questions. So let me address the issue of the Section 13 of the prenuptial agreement first. That has to do with the increase in the value of Doug's separate property. And first off, I think it is an important point that the title of that section is community efforts in managing each party's own separate property interests. And the language is starkly different from the language in some of the other sections, like Section 12, talking about income, says that the parties shall share the same 50-50, and there's an express reference to one half.
Well, and I think that's on page 11, and it says, all income and monies earned during the marriage by Ansel shall be deemed to be community property, and the parties shall share the same 50-50 so long as they remain married. Why isn't that an indication that the meaning of community property is, in the context of this agreement, that means 50-50?
And I want to make sure we're understanding each other. I don't think we're disputing that the words community property imply equal, right? So if something is community property,
but it's 50-50 without having to show that you increased the value or one of the parties did something. I mean, that seems to suggest that when you're using the word community property here, it's a 50-50, and that's provided for by the agreement, as opposed to requiring that you meet the standards of community property tests under Nevada law.
I think I agree with you with respect to Section 12, because it actually says they shall be deemed to be community property, full stop, and the parties shall share the same 50-50 so long as they remain married. But contrast that with the language in Section 13, which says Huff, meaning Irina, shall have a community property interest in the increase in the value of the separate property of Ansel during the marriage. So I think there's a difference between saying that she gets a community property interest with the what that interest is to be calculated by the court under background principles of Nevada law versus just blanket saying that the entire thing is community property.
So are you saying to us that community property interest is different than community property? And if you are, can you tell us the definition of both?
Well, so community property is defined in Section 1 of NRS 225 about existing an equal interest subject to the provisions of NRS 123-230. So I agree, it is equal. But when you're talking about a community property interest, I think that is it's indicating to the court and to the parties that, look, this is a community property interest. We have to define, once we get to the point of defining what that property interest is, yes, it will be divided equally. But you have to actually find what that is under something like a Pereira or a Van Camp analysis that would apply as background Nevada law. I think that's clear on the face of the agreement and by the fact that the parties were careful in other provisions to use to qualify with the words 50-50 or in one half. I think in Section 17 is the language used there. But even if you were to say, oh, well, this is ambiguous, then I think if you look at the extrinsic evidence, by the way, there's a lot of citations to documents that don't exist either in the district court record or at least in the appendix. Again, the appellant does bear the burden on that point.
Where in the amended findings of fact and conclusions of law did the district court make a finding determining that one definition is preferable to the other in terms of the agreement? Where did the court actually interpret this potentially ambiguous term?
So for example, on page 11 of the decree, of the amended decree, at the top of that page, Judge Seda says that while Section 13 of the agreement deals with appreciation in separate property as a result of the parties devoting considerable personal time, skill, service, industry, and effort to the investment and management of their separate property.
Okay, that's what she says there. But if you look at page 5, the court further finds that the prenuptial agreement used some terms interchangeable, not Lee. The agreement sometimes referred to a 50-50 distribution, other times referred to a one-half distribution, and also referred to a community property interest. The court finds the appreciation in the business owned in whole or in part by plaintiff and defendant for the course of this marriage will be shared along a community property interest as defined by Nevada law. That sounds like the court was just picking one and not making a finding that the contract actually required one or the other.
Well, and I mean, I could defend the order in two ways. One would be that she did, in fact, you're right, she did say that the total appreciation was the $2.7 million, and she divided that equally among the parties with respect to the business, with respect to the business interests. I could also argue that even if she were wrong on that point, or she was required to use some other calculation in arriving at that number, that she would have been justified in relying on the plain language of the party's agreement. Plus, if necessary.
But where's the finding that the parties agreed to one meaning or the other in here?
I'm sorry?
Where's the finding that the parties agreed that the meaning in that prenuptial agreement was one or the other? It seems like she just picked one.
Well, and she would have, so I'm hoping I'm not misunderstanding your question. Yeah, she would have, I mean, I think it is inherent in the language on page 11 that she did think that there needed to be, with respect to the appreciation in real property, there would need to be community efforts devoted to that increase in order to apply it. So I think she is adopting that. But even if that weren't, I mean, if you're saying, well, she's just picking it, I mean, we have the testimony from Jeff Steffen at volume 15 of the appendix, page 3160, that talks about if you need to rely on some kind of extrinsic evidence to interpret this agreement, that yes, the parties did intend for Mr. Ansel to get a reasonable rate of return on his separate property that wouldn't be subject, that the entire increase wouldn't be automatically deemed community property. So I know that there was a representation in the brief that Mr. Steffen had testified to the contrary, but what we have is the trial, his testimony in the trial record. At the very least, the district court would have been within its discretion to credit that.
And where is that in the record?
That was volume 15 of the appendix, page 3160. And that's Mr. Steffen's testimony, who represented Doug in the negotiation of the prenuptial agreement.
Are the parties in agreement as to the amount of community property income derived during the marriage? I saw a number of like $1.3 million, et cetera. Did the parties agree to that number, or is that in dispute?
As to the income or as to the increase in the
as to the income earned by the community?
To be honest, I'm not sure. I'll let Mr. Willick say whether he disagrees or not. I know that the Judge Seda in her order said that whether it was the $10 million or whether it was the $8 million, and we do think that Mr. Roston was correct that it was really just the $8 million. That there was no savings on the party. Mr. Ansel testified about how both parties consumed the income, and so there was no.
There was income that was also supposed to be credited between 2015 and 2017, right? Which is when the divorce decree was entered.
After separation,
before the. So what happened during that period of time? Did Irina get the income during that period of time? If she didn't receive it, if she was just receiving support, then why should she be responsible for the tax liability during that time?
So, and she was responding, I mean, Doug was responding, sorry, Doug was responsible for that spousal support during the time. And again, we are talking about tax, income taxes, not corporate taxes, income taxes on community income. So maybe I'm misunderstanding the question, but the district court did find that the community income was equally shared by the parties. And to the extent that there was a necessity of a reallocation, that was taken care of by the support award, but that didn't change the character of the income from something other than community income.
How was it equally shared if after their separation, and this is on page 14 of the order, she finds that he has a current income from all sources of $42,000, but she's only getting, I think it was 15, a little over 15,000, maybe 15.5 a month in support. That's not half of 42,000.
I'll confess, I don't have the answer to your question right now. I'd be happy to supplement if you give me the opportunity later. Do you have any other questions for me? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
His two arguments were quite different.
You were right. This doesn't fit into 15 minutes. May I?
All right, go ahead.
I'll start with the allegedly.
Your time back up to 5 minutes since Mr. Smith went over with the questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll start with the allegedly defective notice of appeal. You had to,
Hang on, I'm sorry. The clock, right?
I couldn't hear you.
We're fixing the clock.
All right, ready.
Okay. The notice of appeal was filled out by staff consistently with prior practice in domestic relations matters. This is one of those places where common practice in family law is a little different than everywhere else. Usually the final order in a family law matter is the decree of divorce, and it incorporates all the pre-existing orders that led up to the decree of divorce. In this case, that's not the final order. The final order is this Rule 52 cross motions order, which was talking about the decree of divorce. In other matters, like all the 60B cases, this court had given direction to only appeal from the final order. I'll draw the court's attention to a state of Adams versus Fellini.
Okay, well, where, let's just assume you're right about that. Would you do it this way the next time?
No, I've already said that I will include extra words to the degree, but there's two words missing. But we were talking about the decree. If you look at the docketing statement, the two issues identified are the primary issues on the decree. Of course we were talking about the decree. That's what this case is all about, is this defective notice of the defective decree. And we know that Judge Seda, frankly, didn't read it because the fact they keep talking about the amended decree, the one that she signed originally when she got the judicial discipline complaint, is missing whole paragraphs.
This court already issued an opinion about signing decrees as submitted by the parties.
Ivazi and others. But the intention, I think, is very clear. Nobody was misled, and there was nobody prejudiced. There were 2 years that went by between the docketing statement identifying the issues that we were going to be talking about and the date of the filing of the answering brief. They didn't object to the docketing statement. They didn't object or give any notice until they made the one line entry in the answering brief and then filed their motion 6 months later. In terms of the prenup, I'd like to follow up on your question. The interpretation should be the plain language of the prenup. And if you are going to look at extrinsic evidence, you look at the evidence from the drafters. I'm going to have to disagree with counsel on that point. Both Mr. Stephan and Mr. Gibbs testified, one at deposition and one in open court, that the intention of the words was to divide everything 50-50, not to give a different meaning of community property to the language that they used. So the language of the drafters is that it's supposed to be, and frankly, I don't care what Mr. Hall had to say about the intention of other people drafting this agreement. The people who put it together said that their intention was clear and they were in full agreement. The income, to answer your question about income, the 1.1 million, I think it was 1.1, not 1.3, is only post-separation. What the decree was dealing with was the millions of dollars that came in during the marriage for which there was no accountability. They certainly didn't divide it. Irina claimed she got very little of it. We found that only 2% of the money was in accounts in her name. But the judge made a point of finding, well, we can't tell who spent what money. And Doug testified that the parties both spent money, so I guess we're going to find that they equally divided all the income during the marriage, which is nonsense. Doug spent all the money basically on himself, and Irina got very little. Public policy, I think, should be addressed. I mean, should be no question that this decree is plain error and a fundamental denial of due process. There's just no way to square it with the law, the court rules, and the prior rulings made by Judge Duckworth. It can't be done. Honesty and the avoidance of wrongful enrichment are consistent with public policy. And in family law matters, there is a heightened interest in reaching matters on their merits under Price versus Dunn. We know that didn't happen here. On remand, we really believe that as a matter of courtesy to the district court judges as a matter of policy, this court should dictate that someone who illicitly commissions an out-of-court ex parte contact can't be allowed to profit from it. If this court issues that directive, it will stop. At present, it's an industry. We documented in the briefing at least 10 times it's been used since this case to try to get rid of district court judges. And it ought to be stopped for the same reason that the bar eliminated it in our recusal rules in the Ethics 2000, which has gone into in detail in the briefing. So we really think that the judiciary ought to be protected in that regard. Going back to fees, we noticed that the prenup required Irina to get fees for defending the prenup. She never did. Page 20 of the thing says she's entitled to her actual attorney's fees. Can I finish this sentence?
Go ahead.
But she didn't, because Judge Seda never entered the reduction of fees to judgment. Judge Duckworth had said that she's entitled to the fees. We submitted the memo of fees and costs, and despite repeated requests for 4.5 years, Judge Seda never entered the fee order, even though it was required on the face of the prenup. We think the fees issue is a big deal, given the numbers involved and given the fact that it was used as an excuse to deprive Irina of everything that the prenup said that she was supposed to get. We really see it as reasonably simple in that regard. Unless the court has some other questions, in the limited time we have, I can't go any further, but there is more.
All right. Anything else? All right. That's it, Mr. Willick. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the time, Your Honor.
Excellent job by all counsel.